Moore's University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Today we continue a conversation that we started with our wonderful guest, Dr. Edward Revelinsky, who I've described in the past and I describe again as a very brilliant academician with background information related to his degrees in sociology and theology from Marquette University, MBA in finance from Rutgers University, and a master's and PhD in the study of religion from Harvard University. We talked last week about his own experiences with the disease of AIDS. And today, I want to welcome you back, Dr. Edward Revelinsky, for our second conversation.
Good to speak with you again.
We know that AIDS goes beyond this country and any small community in this country. And I wondered if you could give us a little bit, first of all, of some of the milestones that have taken place over the development of the disease and its spread, and some of that kind of information that I know that you gather and keep both in your mind, and which I can only look at occasionally on paper, but you know it because you have been, that's your way of working and operating. You've always been a resourceful person who seeks out information. Tell us a little bit and repeat again as to the fact that what AIDS is different from HIV, which you mentioned in our last show, but others need to hear again.
Okay. HIV, again, is the virus that causes AIDS. And HIV is transmitted through, usually, sexual contact, unprotected sexual contact, where there is an exchange of bodily fluids. Other means for transmission are the use of injection drugs. Another means is transmission from mother to infant at birth, where the mother's infected. The child can pick up infection that way. Also, sometimes in certain situations, it can be transmitted through mother's milk as well when the nurse a newborn. So again, and blood directly, and that's the connection between the injection blood, injection drug usage, and blood transmission. In earlier days of the epidemic, also, I mean, there was problems with the blood supply, and we talked a bit about hemophilia and blood product earlier on, until the causality was figured out and proper steps were taken.
Mm. Well, who actually has AIDS? We know in the beginning there were some consideration that this was strictly a disease that affected only gay men.
Mm-hmm.
What can you say about who has AIDS? You just mentioned a couple of options of securing and getting the disease.
The early days of the epidemic in the United States definitely were associated with the homosexual community, especially males. And it manifested itself especially with ferocity on the East Coast, the West Coast, major urban centers. The first wave of the epidemic involved people who did not sit back and suffer in silence. The response of people living with HIV was strong, vocal. One of the early organizations associated with the response was ACT UP. And you may have seen films from those days of street rallies, die-ins, street drama, trying to bring to the public attention what was happening with the epidemic. The epidemic also started showing up, or was showing up at the same time, but in lesser numbers, amongst those who used injection drugs. And basically what happens in that situation is that people would share needles that they would use to inject drugs, for example, heroin, and would share the same needle with someone who they may or may not know was infected. Of course, when you're using a needle where you draw in blood and then expel it and then share the same needle, there's going to be contamination. And obviously, you know, a very effective means of infection. So again, another segment of society that we saw being affected early on was the injection drug using folk. Also, in the early days, people with hemophilia also were affected by the disease, again, through blood product. Over the 25 years plus, the face of the disease has changed. Now the disease is associated much more with communities of color. The incidence of new diagnoses are more likely to occur in communities of color, also likely to occur amongst young people. Also, the ratios are changing a bit, too. In communities of color, women are being affected, and usually through heterosexual transmission. So it's getting much more complex. And not only is it getting much more complex, but other issues then filter into the issue of providing health care to already marginalized populations. And that's sort of where we're finding ourselves right now. We spoke a bit earlier on at the other program about the Ryan White Care Act, which was originally passed in 1990. It was renewed in 1996, reauthorized again another 5 years after that, and we were to have another reauthorization in 2005. 2005 marked a watershed in the governmental perception of what the epidemic is all about and what kind of resources should be put into it.
Let's talk about some of those points you've just made on this before we get to that.
Okay.
You mentioned about the needle exchange, and curiously enough, just this week, we had an article in the press about a bill in the state of New Jersey which would allow drug users to trade old needles for new. What about that exchange of needle program that began to develop some years ago and which now is actually a bill in the state legislature in the state of New Jersey?
This has been a very hard issue to educate people about. And let me tell you, the initial problem in trying to get your head around the issue is it's counterintuitive. If we make needles available, doesn't that promote drug use? And that was the original argument that was put forward when people said we should have needle exchange. In the best of all possible worlds, people would not use drugs. In the best of all possible worlds, people would be responsible, or as much as they possibly could be, in their drug usage. This isn't the best of all possible worlds for those kinds of solutions. The issue comes down to what can we do to mitigate, to lessen the risk involved in certain behaviors. The behavior probably will not go away. How do we lessen the effect of it? So that once you get that idea in your mind, you start saying, well, doesn't it make sense that if people are going to be using injectable drugs, that they should have access to ones that are not contaminated? That was the first kind of activity that was thought of as of having needle exchange. Someone who is a user could take used needles, bring them to a central location. Sometimes it was as casual as a van that people knew would be on a particular street corner at a particular time, or it could be a storefront. Bring their used needles, exchange them for clean, sterile ones. So again, it mitigates some of the transmission. It also provides an opportunity for the contact for the worker to say, what about getting clean?
This article that speaks of the exchange program and the bill that's in New Jersey is saying that the only place in the area and in the region of needle exchange is in Philadelphia, where about 30,000 people live with HIV/AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it speaks to the fact that the World Health Organization has evidently gotten involved with some research to say that they feel that there's enough to show that it at least helps as far as the transmission of HIV/AIDS. They don't speak too much to whether there's increased drug use or not, though.
Yeah, again, some of these things tend to be hard to measure, but what scientific information is out there suggests that does not increase the use of drugs. If anything, at least provides an opportunity for people to consider what are they doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the first step to helping people get out of addiction is for them to realize that there is another choice and get your mind around making that choice.
Yeah. When you speak of the different kinds of problems that impact the development of AIDS among people of color, What do you feel this means? What's causing the increase in people of color and also women?
A couple of different things I think are going on. One of them is the prevention messages that worked for the first part of the epidemic among the gay community may not be appropriate for the minority community, the minority heterosexual community, or even the minority gay community. The messages are not interchangeable. I mean, they definitely have to be thought about as to audience, impact on audience, what's appropriate, and what works best. That's a problem. There's a problem, too, of people realizing that, indeed, they are at risk. If you don't think a lot about ordinary issues of health, the idea of contracting a disease like HIV, AIDS, may not be the forefront in your mind. If you're concerned much more about day-to-day living, about surviving, that's not going to be something in the foremost part of your mind. Access to information about health-seeking behavior, is that appropriate? How do you market just basically being healthy to folks? Again, we see the minority communities that are being affected to be, again, those also that don't have access to resources, especially financial, and find themselves in situations where poverty is perhaps the driving disadvantage, and that sort of sets the tone for everything else. I mean, the message that you're concerned about is, how do I survive? How do I even find affection? How do I live? That's sort of the philosophical and then sociological backdrop. With the rise in the female minority population, a lot of that has to do, again, with finding appropriate mates, partners, especially in urban centers. There have been a couple studies where, as you well know, our prisons tend to be filled mostly with people of color. And the situation in prisons is that disease is easily passed. All the social ills that exist out in society exist in prisons. It isn't often talked about, but it's there. Drug use happens in prison. That's one possible and probable cause for infection in prison. People, when they're released from prison, then go back into the community and take up their life. Mm. Whether or not it dawns on them to be tested or not tested, whether they want to be tested, because, again, that takes a step of courage, is another issue.
Now, we'll talk about that testing. Do you believe that it's best to have the anonymous testing going on or the reporting measures that are needed to try to do some epidemiological studies around the transmission of AIDS?
As we speak, this issue is really at the forefront of discussion and argument. The CDC last week or the week before came out with a recommendation that HIV testing should be routinized. It should be understood to be an ordinary part of a medical examination. It should not require a signed informed consent form. It should not require necessarily pre-test counseling, and not necessarily have post-test counseling either. Heretofore, a lot of the jurisdictions, well, again, this varies from state to state about what kind of information do you give someone when they go for an HIV test. My state, Massachusetts, just recently had to make the decision of reporting HIV infections by name. Before, it used to be reported by code. And there is a point where people don't know what happens with the information.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real issue. Some people don't think it's an issue. The CDC is right now people are talking about, and both healthcare providers as well as people out in the community, of what do you do with the information? So you go into your neighborhood clinic, you know, you have your regular battery of stuff, maybe you went in for blood pressure, maybe you went in for something else, and they run the standard battery of tests, and they also run an HIV test. And then you get the results. From whom do you get the results? From your doctor, from the nurse, from the receptionist?
Mm.
What happens with that information? What do you do with it? Unless there's an intent to treat, the information is not helpful. Unless there is counseling post-test, and if you come up positive, to help someone come to grips with it, because again, HIV is not cured with a shot and a pill. You leave people hanging out there. In some jurisdictions, and this was the case in Massachusetts, in order to have an HIV test, the clinic had to inform you of what you were doing, and you had to sign off on it. If it came up positive, it would be reported, coded to the state. The state would collect all of the records. And there were ways of deduplicating so, you know, you weren't counted twice or that sort of thing. That no longer is accepted by the CDC. It has impact on funding formulas. Part of this is also caught up with, you brought this up too, about usual healthcare protocols for disease tracing.
Mm-hmm.
HIV is the only infectious disease that is not pursued the same way that other sexual infections are. For example, if one were to be diagnosed with, let's say, syphilis, the case would be reported by name to whatever health jurisdiction is in charge of infectious diseases. 10-1, they would send out a nurse who would then contact the person who was diagnosed, then ask them to give them a sex partner history. Those contacts, if it was possible, would be contacted by the public health nurse.
Mm-hmm.
That's the typical way that the sexually transmitted diseases are tracked and treated. Now, again, you may not know that you're infected. I mean, when you're infected by HIV, as I said, you may think you have a very bad case of the flu. Someone comes back to you, you've had the test, maybe you were infected 2 or 3 years ago, and the person would want to take a sexual history.
Hmm.
How effective is that going to be? I mean, what's your memory like? You know, that sort of thing. And then the tracing. How do you trace? How do you approach other people and say, we think you may have been infected by HIV?
There are a lot of issues here. And we're listening to University Forum with my guest, Dr. Edward Rolinski, discussing AIDS and his experiences with it and what's going on in the broader community. Dr. Ed, at least you sent me some materials that deals with what they call AIDS in blackface.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to give some of the things that you said earlier about people of color.
Mm-hmm.
What has the black church and other groups done to deal effectively with this? Since there's so much that goes into, and you're a theologian by background as well, in terms of what the Bible says, and how does that affect what goes on in treating and dealing with this issue of AIDS by the black church today?
This is a very thorny issue, and it's a thorny issue for a number of reasons. First of all, the backdrop. You know, just looking at HIV/AIDS in 2004, which are about the freshest national data we have at this point, there's always a lead lag in analyzing data. For example, African Americans make up about 12% of our population, the national population. However, 50% of the new HIV/AIDS diagnoses in the United States, in the areas where, you know, CDC counts HIV counts as well as AIDS counts, that 50% is African American. So you start thinking something's really radically out of whack here. And part of it is talking about what's happening in our communities. During that same time period, 145 or so infants were infected at birth or through the birth process. Of that number, 73% were African American. So, I mean, there's clearly problems. Now, what is the strongest voice in the black community? The church. What is the problem with both tailoring a message that is pastorally sensitive, that is theologically accurate, and that is effective in having people face the reality of what's happening? That is a conversation that is going on that is more and more being spoken of in public. You know, a lot of it is not spoken about in public, but it is something that the church has to deal with.
Mm.
Some do it quite well. Others say HIV is a curse of God. Whoever gets it deserves it. Wash your hands and walk away.
Mm. Well, the media has had very different ways of approaching AIDS, And sometimes you don't hear anything about it at all. You once mentioned to me that when the treatment processes improve so much, that a lot of people thought, well, it didn't make any difference. All I do, I get treated, and I don't have to worry about it, and so I can go ahead and get AIDS. What's your take on that when someone says that that's the way it is, that they can get out of it? What would you say to somebody who feels that they have a cure, in quotes, so there's no problem?
It truly is, from my perspective, putting your head in the sand. Even though we have available at this time effective drugs that control the infection does not disappear. HIV is able to live in cells quietly throughout your body, and at this point we have no way of getting at those bits and pieces of the virus, and they stay with you. You can control its spread in yourself, but it's still there and it will be with you, so far as we can tell, until you die. People say, well, now it's a chronic disease. Well, yeah, it's a chronic disease. It requires you to live a life of a particular discipline, of taking handfuls of pills, which are not cheap, of never interrupting that regime of medication, of, for example, if you want to have children, there's an issue of, can you? The problem of possibly passing on. Your life is not going to be the same. Yeah, it may be a chronic disease, but do you choose to live with the disease if you can avoid it?
You've had this disease for how many years now?
Well, since the diagnosis in 92.
92.
And this is now 2006.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Because you may not have known at that point that you had it all along. So it has certainly impacted your ability to move on, but at the same time, you've faced it, and when you've had a little setback, and as you say, you occasionally still do have a setback. Is that right?
Oh, yes, and you're never certain what it is that causes the setback. I've had, since last we talked, a couple of crises that may or may not have been associated with HIV, hemorrhaging, several surgeries, bizarre things. A lot of people, it seems now, who are on medication for a long time, develop diseases that they wouldn't see until they were much older. So it seems like the disease speeds on whatever normally develop with old age much earlier.
An aging process speed it up.
Right. A lot of people have a lot of problems with the medication, and there's no two ways about it. They can't take it, or it's not effective. So that means an early, ugly death, and the death is always ugly.
When you say that, what do you mean?
I had occasion a few years ago of helping a person in his last days. And this had been a person who had been very robust, an athlete, 6-foot-something. At the time of his death, I think he probably weighed about 125 pounds. He was in pain constantly, could not eat or hold down food, developed infection after infection, lung infections, things that just were not seen and could not be easily diagnosed and certainly couldn't be treated easily. And effectively in his mid-30s, died of respiratory failure. When you die of AIDS, you die of something else. It's not AIDS per se. It's usually respiratory failure, kidney failure, liver problems, other organs, because, again, that's what it does. It just destroys systems, organ systems.
Given all of that, what should people do to prevent getting AIDS? If this was to be a media blast to try to say how to deal with this, what should we be saying as to how to prevent really getting this condition?
Well, you know, the 100% foolproof way of not getting AIDS is not to have unprotected sex, period. That works, of course, 100%, but we know people are people.
Now, you're talking about unprotected sex, whether it's male to male, female to male, or whatever.
Correct. Limiting sexual partners, being very wary of casual sex. If you're tempted to use injection drugs, try to get clean of that so you can mitigate the problem. If not, try to use sterile stuff. Sterile works. These things sound easy, but then again, if one is in the heat of the moment, and who knows, it's very easy to not be careful, not be safe, or to assume so-and-so looks healthy.
Mm.
The other problem is, in a lot of relationships, can you ask someone, do you feel comfortable enough with the person to ask, what is your status?
Or will they tell you the truth?
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. And, you know, that's another real problem.
Yeah, we're winding down almost to the end of this second interview, but if there were one or two points from a political and policy standpoint you'd like to see happen, what would that be?
Right now, we're talking about the government is, the legislature has just looked at the reauthorization of Ryan White. Basically, we are now being reduced to jurisdictions vying with other jurisdictions for the same pot of money when more people are living with the disease. It is not just, it cannot work, people will continue to die. Ryan White is funded at about $2 billion a year for all of the people that are eligible for the program. For example, our wars abroad cost $2 billion a week. Where are our priorities? What are we doing?
And you would say this not only to this country, but in looking at this from a global standpoint, since we are talking about a very, very interactive world today, that much has to be done at all levels across the globe.
Exactly.
Mm. Have you found in a minute or two that there is any change in the international scene?
I think there's much more awareness. The problem is it's always addressing the issue as it starts to break out. For example, I mentioned early in the other program about Russia and the Baltic states, where the epidemic is just on the edge of bursting out. And a lot of that is through drug use. A lot of that is just the social dislocation of the fall of the Soviet Union and what that's meant for people, and they just haven't gotten the social fabric back together again. India is on the verge of an epidemic, and again, it's basically heterosexual in India, and again, it's people traveling around the country, oftentimes truckers, believe it or not, and the disease is showing up along trade route.
You say it's basically heterosexual, and I think people need to hear this.
Yes.
And to understand that this is not a peculiarity of any one sexual orientation.
Exactly. It is out in the general population.
Mm. We need to see it as something that is so very important to deal with. And I want to thank you so much for our continuing conversation, and I hope we will be doing it again in another year or two.
I too.
And see how things are going. And I thank you so much for being my guest on University Forum.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Edward Revolinsky, a wonderful academician, a wonderful human being, a dear friend. It's just great to talk with you and to see that you're still with us, and I hope that you will be with us for many, many years to come.
Thank you so much.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments on University Forum programs and on our conversation with Dr. Edward Revolinsky to me by email, jemoore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.